the biggest thesis back then and even now is that Web3 isn't secure enough. Facebook wanted to build a stablecoin to power Facebook itself. That was the DM Libra project. They looked at the EVM, looked at the SVM, and decided that it wasn't good enough. So the language itself, it's a lot easier to write code. There's actually some diagram that shows, like, to write account checks for a full module, it takes like the SVM like 2 pages. It takes the EVM like 5 pages. It takes like the MoveVM like 10 lines. If we ever have more than like 1,000 users on chain, the EVM chain simply can't handle the load because you're waiting for one thread. What parallelization enables use at multiple threads. So if you have 10 transactions, instead of waiting for A to B to C to D, you can do A transaction, transaction B, transaction C, transaction D, all at the same time because you have multiple threads within the VM.
This episode is brought to you by Gnosis. Gnosis builds decentralized infrastructure for the Ethereum ecosystem. With a rich history dating back to 2015 and products like Safe, CowSwap, or Gnosis Chain, Gnosis combines needs-driven development with deep technical expertise. This year marks the launch of Gnosis Pay, the world's first decentralized payment network. With a Gnosis card, you can spend self-custody crypto at any Visa-accepting merchant around the world. If you're an individual looking to live more on-chain, or a business looking to white-label the stack, visit gnosispay.com. There are lots of ways you can join the Gnosis journey. Drop in the Gnosis DAO governance form, become a Gnosis validator with a single GNO token and low-cost hardware, or deploy your product on the EVM-compatible and highly decentralized Gnosis chain. Get started today at gnosis.io.
Cars One is one of the biggest node operators globally and help you stake your tokens on 45 plus networks like Ethereum, Cosmos, Celestia, and DYDX. More than 100,000 delegators stake with Cars One, including institutions like BitGo and Ledger. Staking with Cars One not only gets you the highest yields, but also the most robust security practices and infrastructure that are usually exclusive for institutions. You can stake directly to Cars One's public node from your wallet, set up a white label node, or use the recently launched product, Opus, to stake up to 8,000 ETH in a single transaction. You can even offer high yield staking to your own customers using their API. Your assets always remain in your custody, so you can have complete peace of mind. Start staking today at chorus.one.
Welcome to Epicenter, the show which talks about the technologies, projects, and people driving decentralization in the blockchain revolution. I'm Sebastian Couture, and I'm here with my co-host, Federico Ernst. Today, we're talking to Rushi Mancha. He's the co-founder of Movement Labs. They're a network of move-based modular blockchains. Before we talk to Rushi, just want to disclose that Movement Labs is a portfolio company of Interop Ventures. But with that out of the way, hey, Rushi, thanks for joining us.
How's it going, guys? Pleasure to be on here.
Yeah. So we were just talking before the show about like ETH Denver, and I think this is the first episode to come out after the conference, or maybe the second. But yeah, we were both there wearing the Movement sweatshirt, which is very comfy. Yeah. What were your impressions about ETH Denver, and, you know, compared to last year, like how do you think the space has evolved?
I mean, the short answer is we're back. Last year it was like kind of dreary because like post FTX, I think it was like 3 months after FTX and all the debacles, and everyone was like pretty down bad. If you were there, you were like in it for the like actual long term. There weren't that many side events, weren't that many parties, weren't that many like fun things, which is a blessing and a curse. I think last year we saw a lot more like builders coming to the market and actually presenting some cool novel ideas, and there was more signal than noise. And then at Denver, there's a lot of signal, but even more so noise, especially with the rise of the crypto and AI narrative. But seeing a lot of those decks flowing around, honestly, have had a difficult trying to filter out what's real and what's not real. But more importantly, I think it's like great to see the public market. Like obviously, the market's back. Bitcoin's all-time high. Price action is doing well. Private markets are going crazy. So the excitement's back. I think that was really great to see. But I think it's important to know, like, you have to be kind of wary because I think we're heading way too fast in upwards direction. Like, even before the halving, Bitcoin's all-time high, which creates a lot of like macroeconomic questions for how long this goal can last as a super cycle, whatnot. So as like a builder, it's very important to like a focus on distribution, keep like capitalizing the market, but also remaining like conscious that it's probably not going to be a long-term thing, and maybe some economics is suggesting it's a short-term thing. So that kind of adjusts timelines. I think a lot of different infrastructure companies are paying attention to the markets in terms of timelines for product launches and whatnot. So that's one side of the story. I think some key defining narratives, so you had AI, crypto and AI, obviously like intersection as a core narrative. Obviously NVIDIA is going crazy right now, which trickles down to the private markets. And the like modularity, which is still retaining from last year. I think 2023, we still have a DA-focused modularity. So you had like Celestia, Eigen, Avail. And then this year, we put out like Modular Day as kind of the flagship event and really focused on the VM level experimentation. So I moved VM, SVM, WASM VM, and a few different groups really come to market and explain why alternatives to EVM are important. And then restaking, obviously, is a big narrative that Eigen's been pushing on. Looking forward to the launch.
Yeah, I felt like ETH Denver this year could have been just like modular week. It felt like every event had a modular twist to it, or was either like about modular or had like people giving panels about the modular thesis and the modular stack. And like Avail had an event, Celestia had an event, you guys had an event, and tons of other sort of like more Ethereum aligned teams were doing events on modular. Like how important do you think modular is to the current cycle? And in terms of narratives, you know, like what amount of developer mindshare do you think it's actually capturing versus what the markets are saying, like how the markets are perceiving it?
I think modular is now used as a go-to-market term. It's like modular alignment, where you want to structure a company to be interoperable with other networks and ecosystems. Which I think is a good thing. Like if you look at traditional tech or even traditional like hardware, the companies that won were the companies that were able to build parts and hardware that's interoperable with other ecosystems that wasn't tied into one vendor lock-in. I think that's what we're seeing in Web3, where if you're building AI, if you're building oracles, if you're building infrastructure, you want to be able to tie into different ecosystems, different chain, go cross-chain, go multi-chain. And interoperate, because you have a bigger client base, have bigger marketing exposure. So I think modular now is a marketing term, where if you're an infrastructure, if you're an app, you want to be modular so you can align with different ecosystems. Whereas if it's actually a modular, that's yet to be determined. Probably not, honestly. Modular in this case probably refers to using all DA, using experimenting different like VM levels. But I've seen like modular be used for like RPCs, be used for like APIs. So I think modular is like a bigger landscape, which gives credit to Celestia. They've turned their narrative into like a meta, and allows if like a bunch of different companies to align under like one unified umbrella.
And we'll get into the entire modular stack in just a bit, Roshi. But it is your first time on Epicenter. So maybe tell us a little bit about yourself and your background and how you got into this and what made you start Movement Labs.
Yeah, so my background is engineering. Started coding when I was 14. I was always interested in distributed systems, technology, and whatnot. Started software engineering. I worked at United Health Group, led on-prem databases and cloud migration for a team over there. Got into that pretty early on. Then somewhere across crypto, was really interested in all programming languages, especially Rust-based programming languages. So Cosmos, WASM, Rust, Move was really exciting to me. From there, me and my co-founder Cooper, we're both at Vanderbilt University, which is a university in the south of the United States. He was a few years older than me, but I was building one of the first DEXs in Aptos. He built Cité, the first yield dagger in Aptos. So we were early Move builders. This was August of 2022, so pre-FTX, back when like things were better in that cycle. And then we wanted to bring, like we love Move language. I think I stumbled across it because I read like a New York Times article or some like block article where I was like, Facebook's doing this blockchain programming language and their new blockchain initiative. It got me excited because I was always interested in blockchains, but I was always concerned of security and would it ever scale to mainstream consumers. And Facebook is the biggest consumer app on the planet, and they took a bet on programming and started Move language. So I built the first DEX in Aptos that ultimately led to Movement, because we wanted to bring the Moonbeam to Ethereum, like get more to the Move side. But that's kind of how I got here.
Yeah, super cool. Yeah, let's get into the Move side. So basically, Move is a language, as you said, created by Facebook to be more dev friendly, more secure than Solidity and the likes of Solidity like Viper. It's been used for Libra and Diem, obviously, but kind of Sui and Aptos are the main chains that kind of build on it today. Tell us what kind of sets Move apart from, say, Solidity.
Yes, I think going back to the root, Facebook wanted to build a stablecoin to power Facebook itself. That was a Diem and Libra project. They looked at the EVM, looked at the SVM, and decided that it wasn't good enough. They needed their own infrastructure, needed a VM and language that could scale for billions of users, as well as provide security for on-chain. The biggest thesis back then, and even now, is that Web3 isn't secure enough. If I ever want my mom or anyone in my family to use crypto, the biggest thing they're saying is, isn't going to get hacked, isn't going to be rugs, isn't there like a lot of scams going on? And Move was kind of built to combat that from the smart contract level. So it stops like 90-95% of attack vectors we're seeing today in the EVM, as well as provide solvency for some of the attacks we're seeing in SVM as well. So that's kind of the root and origin cost. And then we kind of bring into like why Move. The thesis is, A, was built by the biggest consumer app, bringing in new Web2 developers. Over the next 2 to 3 years, you'll see Sui and Aptos use their big treasuries to attract consumer apps and consumer builders to bring net new developers to the ecosystem. As on the language itself, it was designed to be a blockchain-first language. The analogy I like to say is like Move is to Rust as React is to JavaScript. If you follow JavaScript's history in Web2, it came to market. No one really liked writing JavaScript. And then React came to market and made website generation much easier. Like you can design custom components. You're like object-oriented. Same thing with Move. It's people don't really like writing Rust, but like the frameworks on top of it. So the Move and the Move VM is a framework. You can think of it on top of Rust, where you can design modules that are very custom. You can have on-chain advanced attack protection. So the language itself, it's a lot easier to write code. There's actually some diagram that shows like, to write account checks for a full module, it takes like the SVM like 2 pages. It takes the EVM like 5 pages. It takes like the Move VM like 10 lines, as well as you have embedded on-chain protection. So you have the Move prover at the VM level, which stops RISC, stops inter overflows. It stops all the attack vectors we're seeing today in crypto. So it's the most important innovation security while also being parallelized. So it touches in the parallelized narrative. Block STM was actually built by Aptos Labs, as pioneered by Monad and a few other groups. So think of like the fastest VM and your favorite auditor combined into one VM at one time.
The EVM and Solidity in particular, I mean, they are pretty low level and they let you do a lot of things that other programming languages like Move don't let you do.
Yep.
So for instance, things like inline assembly or something like yep. Move would never let you do this, right? But the reason why it was devised this way was to give developers more freedom in kind of optimizing for things like gas cost, right? So with kind of this more prescriptive language that Move is, you are also somewhat tied down in terms of what you can actually do, especially in kind of a distributed system such as kind of a blockchain ecosystem. Does this concern you that you can't kind of optimize for things as well as you could in the more permissive languages?
I think going back to the Web2 example, like you don't have the flexibility with React or Vue or Angular. It's simply the best framework to build and design websites. If you really want customizations, you can go at like C++ level. You can like generate your own kind of Ruby on Rails frameworks. That's more design specific, like mega use cases. I think there's two sides of argument here. A, Move increases the velocity of production. So let's say, for example, I'm a 24-year-old kid. I want to launch my own DeFi app in 2 weeks. Move is the best way to do that because you can get to market quickly. You can write code quickly. You don't have to worry about account checks. You don't have to worry about keep debugging. So it's the easiest way to sprint on product development. If you do want low-level customizations, the Move ecosystem is actually working on a lot of inline assembly and integrating assembly directly into the Move language. Obviously, it's a nascent language. It was launched like a year ago, so there's a lot of fixes and optimizations are happening. But over the next 3 to 4 years, I'd imagine that Move also adopts a similar low-level support. I think the Aptos team is working on this as well, as we're looking into as well. We actually look at it at the Baikal level, so you could actually directly write Yule, which is like a assembly language, directly to our VM. That's part of our tech stack that kind of differentiates it from Epson Suite. We made it fully even compatible, so you can take the silly code, take the 145 opcodes, and map it to the 54 move opcodes, and launch the VM. Between that process, we have an abstract syntax tree, which enables runtime SDK to understand Yule bytecode, but also if you are a very talented developer and you want customizations at a smart contract level and you want to use assembly, you can write Yule directly to the interpreter.
No, that's super interesting. I had no idea that was happening. How do you feel about the mindshare advantage for the EVM? Obviously, the EVM's been around a lot longer and there's tooling and people know it and there's tutorials and so on. Do you think this can be overcome by kind of like the sort of treasuries that Facebook and Aptos and Sui and so on put into it?
I think it's not a PvP. They both exist. If you want to use Lido today, EVM is the best place to use it and will be the best place to use it for the next 5 years. But the thing, the stance is the EVM, how it approaches legacy code, it is code that works really well for past use cases. When we had 1,000 users on chain, Move is designed for billions of users on chain. It was designed for Facebook to be on chain, which is why you have parallelization, but also you have security benefits. So it's actually complementary, such that you have the EVM for legacy code and legacy software for early kind of web implementations. You can think about Bitcoin script still supports, people still use it for various use cases. But if you ever want to do on-chain consumer, on-chain social, any actual use case that requires high throughput applications as well as security, you need to use a framework like Move. How Move approaches is we recognize the shortcomings of Move itself in terms of a new language, as well as the network effects of EVM, and we combine it. So we have an MEVM where you have Move support as well as EVM support. So if you're looking to deploy Lido on chain or like Aave on chain or Uniswap on chain today, you can use the EVM runtime and interpreter. If you want to build the next biggest consumer app, you can use the Move SDK as well. I think that's the best way to approach next-gen VMs, which is I think a lot of different groups messed up on. A lot of layer ones and next-gen VMs were like, this is our programming language, this is our framework. It's the best thing. If you don't use it, you can screw off. And then they lost a lot of developers. It was difficult to track liquidity. For us, we are acknowledging that EVM still has a liquidity. We want to fully support and actually be as Ethereum aligned as possible while supporting moving long-term and supporting and proliferating its growth.
You talked about parallelization a couple of times there. Can you kind of go into what that means?
So in traditional EVM or any other stack, you have sequential processing, which means you have if you have 10 transactions, it's transaction A to B to C to D. So within a given VM, you're waiting for a transaction to finish for one single thread. Typically in today's crypto environment, sometimes it's not a big deal. If you're using Lido, like you'll have $5 gas fees or whatnot, which for some users, for like big whales, it's fine. If you have $1 million on chain, you pay $5 gas fees. They don't really care. But what parallelization enables you at multiple threads. So if you have 10 transactions, instead of waiting for A to B to C to D, you can do A transaction, transaction B, transaction C, transaction D, all at the same time, because you have multiple threads within the VM. It was first started with like the block SDM process, which Aptos pioneered, which is a new form of parallel processing that enables high throughput parallelized threads. Why it's really important is for two reasons. A, you want low gas fees. So if you look at Near, if you look at Sui, say, they have next to nothing gas fees, which is from parallelization. While if you look at the EVM, you still have Ethereum, which hits like $50 gas fees. Even layer twos today are pretty expensive and they require layer threes to scale. My thesis is that layer threes don't make sense if you have a parallelized layer two because you can have multiple threads that can handle and manage state. The second thing is on if you look at inscriptions as the best use case of parallelization, every EVM chain went down, ZK-SYNC arbitrage went down 120 TPS. If the chain didn't go down like Avalanche, it was at like $50 gas fees, which means that if we ever have more than like 1,000 users on chain, the EVM chain simply can't handle the load because you're waiting for one thread. Think about logic here, right? If you have a high impact event like inscriptions or a game going crazy on one thread and you Uniswap on the same thread, it's going to cause the gas fees for Uniswap to go up. What if there's a world where you can have multiple threads and you have gas fees go crazy on one thread, but it doesn't affect Uniswap, doesn't affect DYDX, doesn't affect GMX and other threads. So you can actually have modularity within the threads itself instead of requiring constant infrastructure upgrades that make no sense at scale. So long story short, parallelization enables concurrent transaction processing, which allows for low gas fees, as well as allows for a management of state during times of high network activity.
There's a lot to unpack here. So I think some of these things in the Ethereum ecosystem are being tackled by intent-based transactions, right? What's your take on those?
I think intent-based transactions pretty early on. I know Shoga is trying to do something for them, like the Modric system. I know 1inch is also trying to push towards that. The general thesis with that, it's like very early stage, it's yet to be proven because there's a lot of interoperability problems. If you try to do intents between like an EVM chain on one like layer two and another layer two, like across is probably the biggest one here. It's very difficult to do like bridging standards, and there's a lot of secure assumptions they're making. But I would say like, yes, in the EVM world, intents is another way to tackle that. But still the fees are generally high, and there's still just because across has intents built to the bridging doesn't mean it can handle high load. If that was the case, inscriptions wouldn't have taken down the chains.
And so basically, when you talk about parallelization, I mean, basically, we used to have this idea in Ethereum that I very much hope is going to return at some point with kind of like smart shards, where basically you have where you have individual execution environments with local states that kind of can interact async with one another. When you have stacks that natively do parallelization, how do you handle the state? How do you make sure that you kind of have one ledger? How do you deal with security?
Well, I think that's one of the benefits of using Ethereum as layer two, as you inherit the network security and the validator set and the kind of decentralization that Ethereum has already built. And you put the MoveVM on top of that and bring parallelization to Ethereum, which is why I think it's very, like, the vision for Ethereum is actually to bring parallelization to the VM level, because you can inherit security, manage state bloat through the settlement and dealers, while you have VMs that can provide performance parallelization. You have like parallelized EVMs coming now to Ethereum, you have SVMs, MoveVMs. So there's definitely like a rise of these virtual machines, but they're all saying that Ethereum is still the best place to manage state and store data.
I'll hand off to Seb here, sorry, intense interrogation here from the EVM camp.
No, these are all great questions. I love it. I was just watching and really enjoying that whole exchange. I mean, to kind of bounce back on what you were saying, Rishi, in terms of, the EVM being legacy code, I sometimes equate EVM, and I know this analogy doesn't overlap exactly, but look at the EVM and Solidity a little bit as I do, PHP. PHP has been around for over 20 years. It is still powering something like 60 to 70% of websites on the internet, most of which are WordPress websites and Facebook. However, ask a college kid today or like a young engineer what language he's building with. Like, he's probably using, like Node.js and React and all these sort of new Web2 frameworks and not PHP. So I sort of look at the EVM and Solidity in the same from the same perspective, where I think the EVM will continue to power very important applications in DeFi, will continue to power these, sort of legacy applications that are going to be, very, very important to Ethereum and sort of crypto infrastructure moving forward. But, as the space moves towards a more modular ecosystem stack, new VMs that are better suited for that infrastructure will probably prevail in those ecosystems. Is that a good way to look at it, or is that analogy missing some parts?
No, I think that makes perfect sense. Like, I could touch on, like, the EVM has done a great job of bootstrapping the initial crypto user base and use cases for DeFi. But there still is a lot of challenges, so that's why these alt VMs are coming, either for performance, security, and a bunch of other different trade-offs to kind of scale existing Ethereum use cases. But, like, liquidity with Web2 is kind of different, where you have, if you have a novel new tech stack, if you have a cool new website, you can essentially vampire attack the existing like user base and bring it over pretty quickly, probably within a 2 to 3 month time span. That's not really possible in crypto because you have financial incentives. So if you have like $5 billion locked up on one ecosystem, it's very difficult to migrate and essentially take all the liquidity over to a new nascent ecosystem, which is why it's more of like a long-term horizon, where you'll see liquidity slowly move to like Solana, which is why like Solana has been kind of crushing it. And, it's been steadily growing TVLs with Aptos and Sui. So we're slowly seeing the liquidity and users kind of move over to the next gen VMs. but it's still going to be like a 10-year process probably before the EVM is at least completely challenged. So in the current state of execution environments is you acknowledge the EVM, acknowledge the liquidity benefits it has, while it's trying to create different use cases for these alt VMs, make sure those use cases actually reach fruition, and then slowly work on acquiring the EVM liquidity once you prove that. I think the two main contenders are this SVM and then MoveVM. A, which have a huge ecosystem backing from pre-existing level ones, and B, have specific teams that are carrying out the alt VM to Ethereum ecosystem.
So maybe just like playing devil's advocate here, like what do you make of the fact that, you know, Barrett Chain is launching an EVM chain, you know, Say also is, I think now dropping CosmWasm to favor a paralyzed EVM in order to, you know, attract more developers. I think they've found it difficult to attract CosmWasm developers. You know, if this is all true, and if like Move and Solana VM are better suited to this kind of new era of blockchain applications, why are, you know, these very large, like especially Barrett Chain, right? Those like large ecosystem play putting the EVM first.
I'll touch on the same point of view where the paralyzed EVM, I would contend, is not the same as the EVM. It's a completely redesigned rich machine. It's just EVM compatible. You can argue that our MEVM is a paralyzed EVM, even though it's a completely different rich machine. So I think the paralyzed EVM is, I would consider, also the next-gen VM because it's a complete redesigned rich machine. This has EVM compatibility from the start. There are security issues with Solidity, but Say isn't really prioritizing that because their go-to-market is being a trading-first chain, being a high-throughput chain, so they don't really care for optimizing for smart contract security. So the simple answer to the Say example, the Mana example, is those are completely different EVMs or VMs. I would not say they're current EVM. They're actually like the Monad EVM when we say EVM, which is completely different. So it still ties in the next gen thesis. And then as for Barrett Chain, I would say that's like the main value prop there is a community. They've done a great job of assembling maybe the most vibrant community in crypto today. And a lot of their activity is based on this proof of liquidity consensus, where it actually doesn't make sense to use a next gen VM because they don't really care about speed. They don't really care about security as much. They're more focused on using governance and using the liquid staking and restaking narrative. But I know, for example, like talking to the teams and different teams there, throughput is a concern for them because even like mempool went down recently, it probably won't be able to do more than like 50 TPS at scale. So like, we're actually going to be working with Barrett Chain and bringing the MoveVM to their system, probably more experimental and down the roadmap. But for any game that wants to launch a Barrett Chain, it simply probably won't work. You'll probably need to like scan exclusion for that.
Yeah, so therefore, like Barrett Chain will sort of act as a security layer for L2s and other app chains that want to leverage Barrett Chain security.
Yep.
Cool. Let's talk about the stack. So, you know, admittedly there are different parts of the stack here that, you know, I mean, even for me sometimes like it can still be a little bit confusing. So, you know, there's M1, there's M2. And the idea here is for like M1 to act as, you know, the sort of like layer one that then enables M2 chains and rollups to launch on top of it. Can you explain like broadly what the stack looks like and where, and also, you know, maybe zooming out, like where these different components sit within the modular stack if we bring in like now Celestia and Eigenlayer, maybe like Union for interoperability, you know, if we're looking at a sort of infographic of this, like what would that look like?
Yeah, so we can start with top down. So execution layer, you have the Movement VM, which is the DM style rich machine, supports Move smart contracts as well as supports EVM smart contracts. So it's an EVM interpreter that's eventually transitioned to Transpiler that exists on top SDK. So any smart contracts, whether you're in Move or Solidity, can exist on the execution layer. Settlement is Ethereum. We believe that's the best security, centralization. Also enables liquidity to easily flow to layer two through a trust minimized bridge. The kind of stack and framework we're using is a zero knowledge rollup. We're using Versio right now for ZK fraud proofs, but also looking to scope out our own ZK MoveVM proving kit. So you have MoveVM execution, ZM settlement, ZK fraud proofs as kind of the rollup framework. And then right now we're using Celestia for DA, given that's the one that's live today, as well as allows for call data to be pushed directly to DA and saves a lot of gas fees. So it's kind of like this Frankenstein of like different layers, which is kind of the direction I think a lot of different roll-ups and integers. And last bit is on sequencer portion. I think today's centralized sequencers cannot scale and do not scale. I think most people agree. If you look at inscriptions, like it literally broke every sequencer that exists. And the simple reason that Arbitrum, zk-sync, and these other teams aren't innovating is because they're making a lot of money on sequencer fees. Because we're a next-gen rollup, our fees are basically pennies. So we don't actually prioritize sequencer fees. We have a fully decentralized sequencer day one that enables validators to stake the move token to participate in sequencing of the layer two. So it's a fully decentralized layer two network where the transaction fees are distributed to stakeholders. Stakeholders take the token to participate in sequencing. So it actually is like a bridge between like a layer one and layer two in that sense.
How do you deal with the decentralized sequencing? Because if you kind of look at the L2 stack on Ethereum right now, no one's really figured this out yet, right? So basically, Aztec are the people who are saying, look, we're not going to do this without, but they're also saying they'll probably launch earliest in a year or so.
Yeah, so I think a lot of different groups like Arbitrum Base, etc., they've all announced, like Optimism Superchain is a sequencer. I think they've all announced that they want to do a decentralized sequencer, but like I touched on, there is no economic incentive for them to prioritize it because they're making a lot of money on the sequencer fees. So it's always like, okay, we'll eventually do that, or we'll work with a third party, but the third party never really works out. So it's always been pushed back. For us, it's directly a priority, A, because we're a high throughput chain. So we need to have a decentralized sequencer to manage the load balancing of the network. And then B, that's our token business model. We need a decentralized sequencer for the validators to have staking privileges, which actually accrues value and buy pressure for the token. So that means we're actually prioritizing as a core part of our tech stack. I think Metis is another one, or Mode, one of those, that has started and launched with a decentralized sequencer. And I think we'll see a lot more of this come. I think Astra is also launching their new layer two of the decentralized sequencer. So teams that prioritize decentralized sequencers will be able to sprint to market, while teams that don't prioritize it have no incentive to do so.
Can you walk us through how it works? So the only technical implementation that I'm aware of is the one that Celo is pushing, kind of who are moving from like an L1 to an L2 network. So how do you go about it?
Yeah, so I think we have a very similar approach to Celo. Celo had a layer one. They now are approaching this like layer two on the ZK Validium. All the validators from Celo were layer one, staked the Celo token to participate in sequencing for the Celo layer two. So that kind of works how we have it, right? So we have M1, which is both Lustrum and Consensus. For those that aren't familiar, it's from the Avalanche ecosystem. That's essentially a fast finality, extremely low hardware requirements, and very decentralized consensus mechanism. That's our sequencer, validator stake the move token to participate in sequencing for layer two. The benefits of using Snowman there is leaderless. When you want to queue transactions, you can have multiple different nodes. So if one node goes down, the network doesn't go down. You don't have a centralized point of failure. And then B, anyone can run a node for the network. So the issues with like Solana apps and SUIs, the hardware requirements are very high. The minimum stakes are very high. So it's very centralized in that sense. With our Snowman consensus, anyone can run a node. It's very low staking requirements. So we can have much more decentralization at network level.
Cool. I want to come back to the stack a little bit. So could you describe like what is the role of M1? So is M1 like the sort of shared sequencer that all M2 chains are going to use? And then how does M1 then connect into IBC and then all of the other like move chains that are part of the broader, you know, move ecosystem?
So you'll have M2 as the main like fraction roll up. Think of like the Optimism chain, the main chain. And then you have M1 as a sequencer, which is kind of analogous to Optimism's superchain sequencer. And then we have other move rollups launching the network. It all sequenced by the same sequencer set, which is M1, which is like the OP stack rollups. So similar business model there. We're just focused on A, launching our sequencer off the bat, and B, on the next-gen VM. So our stack will actually be complementary to OP stack, where you can use the OP stack, use the move stack for the VM, and connect to the sequencer. I think everyone was customizing a DA layer, customizing role frameworks, customizing proven marketplaces, but then not touching the EVM at all. Our stance is we don't believe that should be the case. We want experimentation at the VM level. If you're building a gaming rollup, which we've seen a lot of demand for, you probably want to use the Move VM or SVM, something like that. The M1 sequencer connects all the different ecosystems, allows for liquidity to be routed seamlessly. And then Envision is you have these hundreds of rollups all connected to Ethereum with this decentralized sequencer set.
Fascinating. And yeah, let's maybe just zoom in a little bit to where Celestia fits into all of this and how it supports the roll-ups being built on top of Elm1.
Yeah, so the thesis last year was ETH settlement and ETH DA is really expensive. If more, like Optimism, Arbitrum, the fees are pretty high there. So how can we create Alt DA to really scale Ethereum rollups so that you can still be on Ethereum settlement, but post call data to a cheaper source? That's when Celestia, Eigen, Avail, even Near now kind of position themselves as leaders in the space. From there, kind of like what rollups like ourselves, Eclipse, Manta, et cetera, have already been focusing on is, okay, we're bringing alt VMs and next-gen VMs and different VM stacks to Ethereum. We need to use Celestia because if you have a paralyzed VM on top of Ethereum and you're not using alt DA, it's still being really expensive. You'll inherit the security of Ethereum, obviously it'd be a true L2. But the user experience could be pretty subpar, at least until the full dang sharding is out, which is a few years out at this point. So that's kind of the thesis of using Alt-DA. That also ties into the kind of IBC narrative, which you touched on before. We're working with the union on being fully IBC compatible. They're building out Sol-like kind of machines for us. So essentially, if you want to do cross-chain swaps on top of M2, you can do that with IBC itself, connect to Osmosis, connect to Juno, connect to your favorite Cosmos zones or world chains or whatever you want to call it. Yeah.
So we're recording this on March the 12th, and the Dankun upgrade is going to be tomorrow. So kind of this will give us proto Dank sharding. I think it's pretty obvious that it's not going to be enough, but how much do you think it'll help the entire call data situation?
Yeah, so it's going to be an exciting day tomorrow. So looking forward to that. But to be quite frank, I don't think it's going to be that noticeable. I've seen like some recent measurements and I think it might be a few cents difference. The full Dank sharding as we know it is like 3 to 4 years out, which at that case then we can reassess the needs for alt DA. But I think like Celestia can cut fees down by 99% today, while per Dank sharding is like 0.1%, something like that. So I don't think it really is a factor. I think user experience on main Ethereum will be a little bit better. It's the right step in the right direction. But the truth of the matter is like Ethereum Foundation and like Ethereum itself can't move as rapidly as like Celestia, Eigen, and third-party infrastructure groups. So in the short term and midterm, honestly, all DA sells the market.
And what's the role of like restaking within the sort of movement story, and how does Eigen layer fit into all of this?
Yeah, so restaking has always been an interesting narrative. I think it's definitely probably the hottest thing right now, one of the hottest things. People want to use Ethereum security. There's groups bringing it to Cosmos, there's groups bringing it to like Bitcoin, and just like kind of using more capital efficient markets. We're seeing a lot of layer twos work with restaking providers at the bridge contract level. So imagine you have like Arbitrum, you deposit ETH to Arbitrum, it can natively restake it with like Rio, Renzo, one of these players, and have extra yield. So I think these are much like yield bearing strategies that layer twos are adopting. I think the way we're approaching it is like also similar to that, like having a LRT at the bridge contract. If you're a family office or liquid fund, you get a lot of ETH, you want to deposit on a chain, you can stake it on an LST and then restake it with LRT at the bridge contract level, have it fully automated so you don't need to worry about it, have like extra yield that you wouldn't be able to get easily. And the benefit of us is that because it's fully formally verified, it's actually the most secure way to restake ETH. So we talked a lot of liquid funds. The concern they have is, okay, I want to earn yield, but security is really important to me. I'm a family office. I don't like to take a lot of risk. I just like hold ETH and sell at certain times. So for them, the pitch is, okay, this is the best place to deploy ETH, restake it, earn the yield that you want, and have it fully verified. So it's not security concerns that you're actually worrying about. It actually creates a bigger narrative around insurance, which gets me excited because in the past, insurance has been really pretty much useless because of smart contract risk. There's actually a world where you can, because you have restaked ETH, you can use that as collateral for investment. So if you're like using Aave or Uniswap on chain, you want to use restake as collateral, you can use Eigen Insurance, which is another protocol they're working on, as collateral for the investment. So that's another ABS that's actually really exciting, especially for Move, because the security gaps enable it to be much more risk adverse, or much more risk better. Which enables interest rates to be lower, which enables retail capital to come in more easily.
Any thoughts on the rise of Bitcoin L2s? Because kind of we've, in the past months or so, those have been all the rage, right?
Yeah, I think like personally, I don't really understand that well. I'm not that deep in the Bitcoin space, so like the Bitcoin programming space. I'm sure there's other people that can speak better to it. For my understanding, it's like a way for people to you take existing Bitcoin reserves, put it on chain, or put it into what are now like custody multi sigs or side chains, and earn yield for that. So in the short term, it makes sense. It's a way to generate yield, and it's a way for layer twos or whatever you want to call it to bootstrap TVL. I believe Merlin Chain got like 2 billion, 3 billion TVL in a week or something crazy. And I think a lot of ecosystems are now looking at that. How can we acquire Bitcoin liquidity? In the past, wrapped BTC was always available, but family offices, liquid funds don't really want to wrap BTC because the whole process, gas fees are really high. It's not a risk. So BTC L2s enable native Bitcoin to exist and be repurposed for yield. So I think what a lot of different groups are looking at is how can we integrate something like Babylon, integrate like the BTC accrued from there and earn yield for our system. So something that we're looking into is there a world where we can bring native BTC via Babylon or other infrastructure providers and have that used in DeFi? But obviously we're experimental and probably more down the roadmap. But I think like Bitcoin itself is here to stay. I think the ETF proved that it's going to be like currency of gold. It's not going to be very programmable. I don't imagine the next social or gaming app being built on these BTC L2s. I don't think that's possible at my current knowledge. I think it's just a way to repurpose BTC, which is cool. So I think short-term play makes sense. Long-term, I'm kind of unsure. But teams like us are looking to kind of leverage that for existing TVL security benefits.
Yeah, I personally think that Bitcoin is going to play a bigger and bigger role in the layer two narrative in the coming year. And you know, a lot of that I think is fueled by, you know, the ETF bringing like lots more liquidity into the space, but also a lot of the kind of technical developments that are happening there. So there was this Bitcoin Renaissance event at Denver, and I think like half of the teams that had booths there were building some kind of restake Bitcoin product or liquid stake Bitcoin product. And I think that, you know, given Bitcoin's position as like the largest and more secure blockchain, it makes a ton of sense for that capital to be utilized, one in DeFi through liquid staked assets. Whether like that's technically possible, that you can do sort of trust minimized versions of Bitcoin on other chains is going to be very important. Like, you know, we don't want this just to be a multi-sig. But then, yeah, the security aspect, I think, is also huge. So like whoever figures that out and brings it to market, I think will do very well. I want to move on now to, you guys announced a couple of months ago a partnership with, Union and Noble. And I was really excited about this because we're all also very bullish on those two teams. Yeah, how does this help bring USDC to movement? And can you describe maybe like the role of Union in bringing IBC to, you know, the movement ecosystem, but also Cosmos and Ethereum, and sort of tying it all together so that we can have fungible USDC across all these platforms?
Yeah, I think like IBC has always been like regarded as like the most secure, one of the best bridging standards in the market. And there's like a bunch of transport layers on top of that, which like layer zero, Wormhole, Hyperlane. Recently, Wormhole is that's the Worm chain, which is like Gateway now, which is their Cosmos adaption. Layer zero and Hyperlane both have also IBC adaptions. You have Axelor as well. So all the biggest bridging protocols all use IBC under the hood, but they use it probably in a non-native way. It's really difficult on the UX point of view to use them. Like for Wormhole, you have to bridge to Gateway and then bridge Gateway to respective chains. There's lack of native IBC connections. So there's a few groups that have emerged to kind of solve this problem. You have like Polymer Labs, you have like Composable Finance, you have Union Labs now. They're now looking at different ways to bring IBC natively to systems. So part of our partnership with Union is they're working on building direct Litecoin machines for a layer two. So if you're a dApp on top of Movement, you can do transactions directly to Osmosis, do it to other chains. It starts off through the Union chain, I believe, but eventually there'll be native IBC compatibility, which is really exciting because now you can have native USDC, you can have Atom, Tia, you can get the benefits of all the Cosmos assets that people want on chain without relying on a third party insecure bridge provider. But I think my general thesis is that IBC is the Cosmos standard. I know we touched on this at the convergence, where Cosmos accomplishes the vision, the internet of blockchains, where every roll up every L1, L2, L3, whatever you want to call it. We'll use IBC as a main bridging provider, bridging standard under the hood. It's just depending on like what are the wrappers on top of it and transport layers on top of it that facilitate that. So you have like Wormhole doing it from like their point of view, which is more third party and more trust reliant. And you have like Union and Polymer, which are looking to kind of address the security assumptions and increase speeding times. Union specifically is looking at ZKIBC. They built out Comet BLS, which is a new standard for messaging. So I'm pretty excited and bullish on them, which is kind of why we're working with them.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned convergence because there's a couple of topics that we touched on at the event that I'd like to bring up here. So, you know, one of the topics that we talked about was USD denominated asset dominance in crypto. So obviously like USDC and Tether are, you know, by a large margin leading in stablecoin issuance, you know, over things like DAI and other decentralized stablecoins. Do you think this, like, you know, Karel from Union was on the panel also. And so I encourage those who haven't seen that to go check it out. It's on the Nebula Summit YouTube channel. We'll link to it in the show notes. But, you know, he was saying that, you know, he felt that there was a risk to crypto to having these, well, one, like centrally issued stable coins. But also, I think another topic that another sort of point that I haven't heard brought up very often is, you know, this USDC denominated stable coin. So this kind of like US alignment, US dollar alignment risk. You know, do you see that as a risk? And, you know, how can one mitigate that considering the fact that these stable coins already have like such dominance over the space?
So yeah, we discussed like USDC dominance, and my thing is like I'm actually pro Circle dominance in the short term, because if we already have very few users on chain, and like if you ever want like consumer safety right now, we need like a third party like big provider like Circle, Coinbase to really issue these assets and provide confidence to retail users. Like going back to my example of like family using crypto, if I told them to use like DAI on a Maker or like some of these other stablecoin providers, they're probably freaked out and be like, what is this? If I said it was like, okay, it's a stablecoin issued by Circle, like now probably going to be a public IPO company, very US regulated, has a lot of rules and regulations, they'd feel a lot more comfortable. So there's like two kind of markets here, right? You have like retail, which is like people who don't really know crypto at all. They want to explore with it. You need Circle, you need a Coinbase, you need centralized authorities for them to feel comfortable. And then you have the experience on-chain degens. People have been trading for years. They recognize that in the world that Circle kind of goes rogue or Coinbase goes rogue, they want the ability to safeguard their holdings. That's why DAI is really interesting. That's why USDT is interesting. There's now like Athena, which is not a stable coin, but they're providing different investment kind of issuances. So I think there's different groups for those categories where you can provide solutions and stable coins and assets for more Web3 native people. But to bring in people to space, you do need centralized authorities. So I'm actually pro Circle, pro Coinbase issued assets.
Yeah, I think that makes sense to me. I think in the short term, it makes sense. You know, looming in the back of my mind is always this censorship risk with USDC. I think that's really the main risk that I see. But as the space becomes more regulated, that is going to be the case. Also, most likely, like, I mean, all applications and dApps will be subject to potentially like having to censor transactions that don't fall in line with like compliance. Yeah, in terms of, yeah, like this Cosmos and Ethereum convergence idea, which was the main topic of the panel in Denver. Yeah, what's the end game here for you? Like, in terms of Cosmos and Ethereum coming closer together and benefiting from each other's sort of strong points, where do you see that heading towards?
I think Ethereum is used for liquidity, is used for settlement security, while Cosmos is used for communication. I think Cosmos has a lot of different features. They had Tendermint, they had SDK, they had IBC, they had CombFT, they had the whole zone thesis with like custom app chains. I think a lot of the times the zones had a lot of struggle with obviously tokenomics and bootstrapping validators. That's pretty difficult. But the one thing that was always prominent and like beautiful was if you had multiple zones, you could use a Cosmos SDK and get connected to Osmosis, get connected to your favorite chains, and it's permissionless interoperability, which is kind of like Hyperliquid's motto. But I really see that kind of mantra spreading towards the Ethereum and the modular stack, where you're in this world where you have all these rollups and all specific chains, you don't want to wait for a third-party bridge provider to always deploy. If I'm building a new gaming chain and I want to launch 3 weeks, I shouldn't have to wait for Layer 0 or any other kind of third-party bridge provider to deploy on top of me. I should be able to use IBC or some third-party bridge standard to get connected to my favorite chains so I can sprint on my product. So I think that's where IBC has a unique market where it enables for permissionless interop. I have a few different groups building wrappers on top of it, but IBC is a standard that's going to be adopted for this mass welcoming of chains that's coming. Whereas Ethereum is still like the programmable computer where people build on top of it, using it for liquidity, using it as like a supercomputer, and then IBC is connecting on it. So I think the Cosmos Ethereum narrative and the Cosmos Ethereum vision is coming to fruition today, where maybe Cosmos Zones don't win, but IBC wins, which means that Cosmos wins, and maybe that Ethereum layer, like Ethereum layer 2 and Ethereum DAs don't really make sense. There's also a question about like, what is a rollup? If you're rolling on Celestia, does that mean that you're a rollup? Or does it mean L2? I think that's a frivolous debate. I think as long as you're using Ethereum some capacity, doesn't really matter.
I think that if IBC wins, everybody wins. I think it's not so much about like, I think the end game is just, you know, and Ethan Buckman and Sam Hart were talking about this on an episode of, I think it was like one of the Blockworks podcasts recently, and they were talking about the end game. And like the end game is all chains using IBC and benefiting from this amazing interoperability technology. And then, you know, if I take it even a step further, and this is sort of Carell's point of view, is that we have this swarm of validators that is validating the state of all these chains. And as an application, you know, like there's just, you don't know who's validating your transaction, but it's being added to this massive sort of swarm of state, this massive state that is secured by the swarm of validators. I kind of see that as the end game, where Ethereum sort of sits at the bottom layer, provides the liquidity, provides a major part of the security, but Cosmos, you know, through the construction of the Cosmos stack and been at the forefront of modular with the AppChain thesis, brings the technology and the technical philosophy to build out applications in a way that makes sense.
I'm 100% with you both that kind of IBC is kind of like the absolutely golden part of Cosmos. So I think this is something that kind of the Ethereum ecosystem is lacking. And
bad kids.
We see it.
Yeah. And bad, I think bad kids always win.
There was a podcast probably already a year and a half ago, also with Ethan on Bankless, interestingly, where kind of he argued his thesis that Ethereum is kind of like this empire where kind of everything ultimately settles back to Ethereum, whereas kind of Cosmos is like this network of city-states with kind of like pockets of value. So now in this Cosmos and Ethereum convergence picture, how would that kind of translate into this metaphor?
In terms of like cities and states, like where...
Yeah, in terms of like having like a giant empire where basically everything's kind of like inverted pyramid shaped and everything ultimately settles back on mainnet where...
So yeah. Like that's, I would say like the United States, I would say like the US for example, the United States would be Ethereum. You have a bunch of different states, which is like, yeah, like movement is one state, you have like another roll-up is another state. You have all these different states that are all the roll-ups. And the highways that connect all the different states is IBC, where you need like connectivity between the different states. Otherwise, if you're from California, you can't get to New Jersey. If you're from like Oregon, you can't get to Florida. So that's like the main problem actually today in crypto is like, if you look at like earlier settler stage when America was first developed, this is probably just my inherent American coming out. But like when there was like really, it's really hard to like travel between different states and different regions back in old America. When they built roads out and transportation properly, it was really easy to get between different states, which enabled people to network easily and meet their family and friends. Same thing in today's crypto, where you have Ethereum, which is like kind of the barren land. It's like the 1700s, if you would say, where you have all the different states kind of forming, but still kind of figuring out what their markets are. Like California was a gold state at one point. New York was a financial hub. People were still trying to figure out their hubs in that case. And then the main thing that's missing is kind of the roads between different chains, or in this case states, which the IBC is positioned to be the best candidate. I would say IBC would be the asphalt in this case, or the concrete, and then like different groups. This is getting really in depth to it, but like, then like you have like Union, Polymer, and different groups that are actually building the specific rogues, if that makes sense.
We talked about adoption kind of depths that will serve, you know, hundreds of millions, if not billions of people in the very beginning, kind of when we talked about Facebook's motivation to create Move. So what does the future look like for Move and Ethereum, and kind of when do you think we'll see the first dApps that actually have that sort of mainstream appear?
To plug myself, I would say like our mainnet, but the real answer would be like it depends on what your real apps are. Like I think there's no apps in crypto yet. We don't have any real apps yet. I'm talking about like we don't have like an on-chain social app. We don't have anyone that my parents are talking about, my friends are talking about. So we're still very early on that. To like, we can say like, oh, we'll have X amount of DeFi apps, X amount of TVL, but who really cares? It's just another like copy pasta of another layer two. We're trying to build infrastructure and apps that mainstream people can use, send payments at the speed of light across the world. So I would say like the moving system is poised to carry that thread the best. A, because you have backing from two of the biggest consumer chains on the planet, and then B, like the language itself is designed for consumer development. So I would say within like 3 years, we could see like a really prominent consumer social app that gets a lot of traction. But in the short term, you'll see like much more proliferant secure DeFi strategies compared to like traditional layer twos and traditional Ethereum solutions.
Great. Do you want to share a little bit about, sort of short-term and roadmap for Movement? When can we expect mainnet, and how can people start building on Movement or perhaps getting involved?
To get involved, like go to Discord, check out like our builders community. Movement Labs XYZ is a website. Follow me on Twitter at Ushimanche. And then we're rolling out a lot of stuff end of this month. We're starting with some announcements coming on fundraising, as well as like testnet announcement coming out next month. So DevNet's fully live, as well as incentivized testnet shortly.
Awesome. Rushi, thanks so much for coming on Epicenter and expanding our minds on the alt-VM thesis and why Movement is going to the moon.
For sure, man. Thanks so much for having me. Really appreciate the time.
Thank you for joining us on this week's episode. We release new episodes every week. You can find and subscribe to the show on iTunes, Spotify, YouTube, SoundCloud, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And if you have a Google Home or Alexa device, you can tell it to listen to the latest episode of the Epicenter podcast. Go to epicenter.tv/subscribe for a full list of places where you can watch and listen. And while you're there, be sure to sign up for the newsletter so you get new episodes in your inbox as they're released. If you want to interact with us, the guests, or other podcast listeners, you can follow us on Twitter. And please leave us a review on iTunes. It helps people find the show, and we're always happy to read them. So thanks so much, and we look forward to being back next week.